CBS News Face the Nation in 60 seconds.
While most video surveillance solutions capture and store hours of nothing, CUDA Eye by Barracuda Networks only captures video when something happens. Once captured on camera, the video evidence is immediately encrypted and sent to the cloud for safe storage and easy retrieval from any web browser or mobile device. With CUDA Eye, there's no network configuration or software to install. Just plug one or more cameras into your network to better protect your business. Don't get caught with nothing. Do something about it. Check out CUDAEye.com. That's CUDAEYE.com.
Hi, this is John Ondrasik of Five for Fighting, here for RAD, the entertainment industry's voice for road safety. You know, style is a personal thing, and your lifestyle is your business. But if you take it on the road, it becomes everybody's business. So please, plan ahead, designate before you celebrate. Friends, don't let friends drive drunk.
A public service announcement brought to you by RAD, the National Association of Broadcasters, and the Ad Council.
Today on Face the Nation, with just under 30 days until the Iowa caucuses, we go one-on-one with frontrunner Donald Trump. As the candidates got back on the campaign trail after the holidays, we sat down with Donald Trump and talked about his prospects in the hotly contested Iowa caucus.
I'd love to win Iowa, and I could have said it differently. I could have said, well, I'd be okay. No, I want to win Iowa.
Plus, we'll hear his thoughts about a new terror video featuring his controversial position on Muslims.
For a total and complete shutdown of Muslims entering the United States.
Does it concern you at all that you're being used in essentially a recruitment video by a terrorist organization?
They use other people, too. I mean, what am I going to do? I have to say what I have to say.
Trump also weighs in on Hillary Clinton and Ted Cruz and talks about his priorities and style as president.
You know, I would be a much different person, I think, as president.
And we'll look ahead at what 2016 will hold for the war against ISIS, U.S. foreign policy, and President Obama's last year in office. It's all coming up on Face the Nation. Good morning and welcome to Face the Nation. I'm John Dickerson. We begin the new year with campaign 2016, and one of the people who continues to shake up the political world, Donald Trump. We caught up with him at his home in Palm Beach on New Year's Day and started our conversation with President Obama's expected plan for new executive actions on guns, including expanding background checks to purchases at gun shows. We asked Mr. Trump what he thought about the president's plan.
Well, I don't like it. I don't like anything having to do with changing our Second Amendment. We have plenty of rules and regulations. There's plenty of things that they can do right now that are already there. They don't do them. We have a tremendous mental health problem. We're closing places all over the world, all over the country they're closing. So nobody's doing anything about that. All they want to do is blame the guns. And it's not the gun that pulls the trigger. So I don't like it. I don't like what he's doing. I think that he's looking to do executive orders to do something having to do with guns.
Background checks happen for normal gun purchases at a normal store. So his argument would be you just do it here. It's this loophole. You want to make it the same everywhere.
John, I'm going to have to take a look at it, but I don't like changing anything. Right now, they have plenty of rules and regulations, and they should be looking at mental health. I mean, we should build, like, institutions for people that are sickos. We have sickos all over the place. And that's the problem.
So you'd spend some more money on that, maybe?
Here's the problem. I would definitely spend more money on that. Here's the problem. The bad guys are always going to get the guns. You can have all the restrictions you want, but the bad guys are always going to have the guns.
Let me ask you about executive orders in general. Like them, don't like them, that the president uses them to go around Congress?
Well, I don't like them, and our country wasn't based on executive orders. Nobody really knew that we even had an executive order, such a thing. It's supposed to be you get along with Congress and you cajole and you go back and forth and everybody gets in a room and we end up with deals. And there's compromise and lots of other things, but you end up with deals. Here's a guy just goes, he's given up on the process and he just goes and signs executive orders and everything.
So if you were president, you seem like the kind of guy who, if you were president, you might use an executive order or two, though.
Well, I will say this. There's a lot of precedent based on what he's doing. Now, some have been, you know, his executive order on the border. Amazingly, the courts actually took that back a step and did something that was very surprising, which is they did the right thing. So that maybe that one. But I would be rescinding a lot of executive orders that he's done. I mean, the one thing good about executive order, the new president, if he comes in, boom, first day, first hour, first minute, you can rescind that.
Let me ask you about a video that's been put out by Al-Shabaab. This is an ISIS-affiliated terror group. And in the video, they use you, Donald Trump, a clip.
Donald J. Trump is calling for a total and complete shutdown of Muslims entering the United States until our country's representatives can figure out what the hell is going on.
And then the video goes on and says, the West will eventually turn against its Muslim citizens. They're saying to Muslims, either you join jihad or leave the United States because of what Mr. Trump is proposing.
Look, there's a problem. I bring it up. Other people have called me and they say, well, you have guts to bring it up because, frankly, it's true, but nobody wants to get involved. Now people are getting involved. People that are on different persuasions than me right now, John, are saying, you know, maybe Trump isn't wrong. We want to examine it. There's a lot of bad stuff going on. I'm watching the news tonight, actually, CBS. And so many of the elements, you look at Germany, you look at Brussels, you look all over the world, they're shutting down cities that never had a problem before. They're shutting down countries that never had a problem before. You look at Paris, what happened. You look at California, what happened. John, maybe it's not politically correct. There's a big problem out there, and we have to solve the problem.
Does it concern you at all that you're being used in essentially a recruitment video by a terrorist organization?
They use other people, too. I mean, what am I going to do? I have to say what I have to say. And you know what I have to say? There's a problem. We have to find out what is the problem, and we have to solve that problem.
Do you think the problem is that the West is on a collision course with radical Islam, or is this just ISIS is a problem? I mean, is this a clash of civilizations?
I think that radical Islam may be on a collision course with us. I mean, you could change it around a little bit. But it is a very, very deep-seated hatred that's going on. I mean, you have a hatred like people wouldn't, where they're willing to give their lives, they're willing to walk in. I have to tell you, it is so big. It is the biggest thing there is right now. When I watch President Obama say global warming is our biggest problem, it's just so sad to watch. And he doesn't want to use the words radical Islam. He doesn't want to use anything having to do with radical and Islam. So until he's willing to admit the problem, how can you not at least talk about the problem? And one of the things I've done is I brought the problem out. The world is talking about what I've said, and now big parts of the world are saying Trump is really right, at least identifying what's going on, and we have to solve it. But you're not going to solve the problem unless you identify it.
Let me ask you some questions about the presidency and a Trump presidency.
Okay.
Will you talk as much as a president as you do as a candidate? Will you be on TV all the time, giving rallies, that kind of thing?
Well, I think I would be giving rallies. I want to rally this country because our country has no spirit. I would certainly probably not talk as much. Look, right now I'm going, originally we had 17 people. Now we're 14 people and 13 people. A lot of people are going to be dropping out.
You mean other candidates in the race?
Other candidates. And so, obviously, I have to do a lot of talking. You know, I'm getting hit from 15 different sides. I like to defend myself, right? But, no, I would be a much different person, I think, as president. But I would be very enthusiastic, like I am right now, toward the country. We need spirit. We need a cheerleader. President Obama is a bad cheerleader. I thought he'd be a good cheerleader. I thought he'd be a great cheerleader, actually. That's the one thing I thought, is that he was going to be a great cheerleader. He's really a big divider. We need cheerleading.
We talked to some of your supporters, and a few of them said when Donald Trump gets in to be president, he'll have people to coach him and kind of take off these rough edges of the things he says. Are they right?
I don't think I have rough edges. I'll be honest with you. I went to an Ivy League school. I was a good student. I went to the Wharton School of Finance, the best business school in the world, probably, certainly, I mean, one of the great schools of the world. And I can be more politically correct than any coach that they can get me. I can be the most politically correct person with you. I could say something at the end of this interview. You would say, wow, was that boring?
Give us a perfectly political correct thing.
Here's the problem with political correctness. It takes too long. We don't have time. We don't have time. I talked about anchor babies at one news conference. And one of the reporters, actually from ABC, said, that's a derogatory term. I said, why? He said, well, it's derogatory. He didn't know why. And then I said, well, what would you call them? The babies of undocumented immigrants. He gave me like a 7 or 8 word definition. I said, we don't have time for that. I'm sorry. We don't have time for that. Now, look, I can be the most politically correct person that you've ever interviewed. It takes too much time.
Isn't there a cost? I think all the names they call you because of the things you say.
Well, think of the fact that I'm leading in the poll by tremendous margins. And, you know, I think that's part of it, too. People don't want political correctness. They're tired of it today. And I think that's one of the things that has resonated with me. I don't go out of my way to be politically incorrect.
When you think of the presidency, the day-to-day, not the show part, not the outside, what's it going to be like? What do you think about that, the operations?
I don't think about it because, look, here's the thing. What I think is the process. We have a lot of things to solve. We have a health care problem that's incredible. Obamacare is going up 25, 35, 45%. You see the deductible, what's happening. It's going up so high you're never going to be able to use it. You look at ISIS. You look at our militaries and shatters. I mean, you know, when you have General Ordiana saying it's not prepared, we're not prepared. As a military, we're not prepared. It's been one of the worst. You know, he said, and he actually said from the beginning, I watched him on an interview. He was talking about lack of preparedness from the beginning. You look at our vets, how badly they've been treated. You look at our borders, how people are just pouring across our borders. There's plenty to do.
They talk about the presidency and who has the finger on the button. The United States has not used nuclear weapons since 1945. When should it?
Well, it is an absolute last stance. And, you know, I use the word unpredictable. You want to be unpredictable. And somebody recently said, I made a great business deal. And the person on the other side was interviewed by a newspaper. And how did Trump do this? And they said, he's so unpredictable. And I didn't know if he meant it positively or not. It turned out he meant it positively. We have to be somewhat unpredictable in this whole thing. Nuclear, though, has to be an absolute last stance. Don't forget, I was against the war in Iraq. I'm not a fast trigger. You know, you have guys that you would think are, you know, very, very low-key. You know, they'd be faster than me. I would be a very slow trigger with nuclear. Nuclear is a major problem. And we have major problems because you have other people that would be very fast. And you look at North Korea, you look at some of these countries, I don't think they'd hesitate to use it if they really had it in a proper
manner. So only if the United States is attacked.
Maybe. It's really a last resort as far as I'm concerned.
President Obama signed or said no more spying on our allies, but there's a report in the Wall Street Journal that there was spying on top Israeli officials. Would you say no spying on Israeli officials at all?
I would certainly not want to do it, but I have to say this. We're being spied on by everybody. And it's terrible what's going on in that whole thing. I mean, we find out that we're being spied on by them and they're being spied. Everything's out. You know, the one bad thing about the computer generation, I have a son. He's 9 years old. And he can virtually take apart any computer. These people are so brilliant with computers. You know, in the old days, when you're fighting a war, you give somebody an armed guard, and he has an envelope in his pocket, and he hands it to the general. Now it's going through so many channels, you don't know who's getting it. It's a real problem.
So
the problem with the computer age is I don't think you have secrecy anymore.
So you'd leave open the possibility of spying on anybody, even allies?
I would say that I would leave open possibilities of doing whatever it takes to make our country very, very strong and to make our country great again.
Let's talk politics for a
minute.
You said that Senator Cruz appeared to be kind of copying your immigration plan. Your plan, as I understand it, is deportations, and then you'll let the good ones back in once they've left the country.
Well, they have to go through a process.
They go through a process. His plan is just deportations.
Okay.
So is he stricter on undocumented?
No. Well, first of all, his plan just happened, okay? In fact, I was watching the other day, and I was watching Ted talk, and he said, we will build a wall, the first time I've ever heard him say it. And my wife, who was sitting next to me, said, oh, look, he's copying what you've been saying for a long period of time. No, I'm talking about deportation, and people can come back into the country, not just that group, but other people can come back, but everybody has to come into our country legally, and I want a strong border, and I'm the one that came up with it. Look, when I announced that I was running, I brought up illegal immigration. It wasn't even a subject that would have been discussed in this debate, and now it's one of the very big subjects. Ted Cruz is trying to step up his whole game on amnesty and on illegal immigration because it was actually quite weak. And you listen to him and Marco Rubio, they're trying to, you know, solve the problems that they've had in the past because they were both weak on it. And I have been very strong on it. So they're trying to get stronger on it. But look, nobody has that position like I have that position. I want the wall. I want strong borders. I want everybody out. Now people are coming to me. But nobody has that issue like me. And nobody's going to be able to do it like me. Nobody, as an example, on the wall, nobody is getting Mexico to pay for the wall, the cost of the wall, but me. They don't even know about that. It's not even in their vocabulary.
But nobody thinks you're going to get Mexico
to pay
for the wall.
You know why? They make a fortune with us. So much more money than what you're talking about. They're making a fortune. We have trade deficits. We have... If you look at the kind of numbers that Mexico makes with us, the wall is peanuts. Only a business person would say that. The politicians don't understand it. They're all talk and no action.
Wouldn't you said that the good ones would come back on an expedited basis? Wouldn't Senator Cruz say, well, that's amnesty?
I think that the good ones will be coming back, and I would say that we want to have them back, but we want to have a lot of other people. You know, we have one problem. We have millions of people waiting on lists that have gone through a legal process and they can't get into the country. We have to take care of them. I want people to come in. They just have to come back legally.
When you say about Senator Cruz, not too many evangelicals come out of Cuba, what does that mean?
Well, it just means that Cuba, generally speaking, is a Catholic country, and you don't equate evangelicals with Cuba. I don't. I mean, I think of evangelicals, and I have I'm Presbyterian, I'm Protestant, but I don't see it as coming out of Cuba.
But you're not questioning whether, I mean, as far as you know, he could be more devout than you are.
It's possible. Certainly it's possible. I'm not questioning. And I say it in a somewhat smiling manner, but there's a little truth to it.
Face the Nation, coming up next.
You don't have to be a retail giant or government agency to be the victim of a costly data breach. If you run a website and collect customer data, your small to mid-sized business is just as likely to be targeted by hackers. The Barracuda Web Application Firewall provides cost-effective instant security against automated and targeted attacks, making this WAF a must-have for your SMB. Reclaim your network. Try a Barracuda Web App Firewall risk-free at barracuda.com/WAF.
We're back with more of our interview with Donald Trump.
Hillary Clinton, what does it mean when you say she's playing the woman card?
Oh, she's constantly playing the woman card. It's the only way she may get elected. I mean, frankly, I don't think anybody, personally, I'm not sure that anybody else other than me is going to beat her. And I think she's a flawed candidate. And you see what's happened recently, and it hasn't been a very pretty picture for her or for Bill, because I'm the only one that's willing to talk about his problems. I mean, what he did and what he has gone through, I think is frankly terrible, especially if she wants to play the woman card.
What does it mean, though, to play the woman card, in your view?
Well, she's playing it. She's just, you know, she is pandering. She is pandering to the public, and she's pandering to women. And when she did it with me, she talked about sexist, and I said, me, I have more respect for women by far than Hillary Clinton has. And I will do more for women than Hillary Clinton will. I'll do far more, including the protection of our country. She caused a lot of the problems that we have right now. You could say she caused the migration. Look at the problems in Syria.
You mean as Secretary of State?
As Secretary of State. I mean, the entire world has been upset. The entire world it's a different place. During Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton's term, she's done a horrible job. She's caused so many of the problems. And let me tell you something. She's caused death. She's caused tremendous death with incompetent decisions. I was against the war in Iraq. I wasn't a politician, but I was against the war in Iraq. She voted for the war in Iraq.
You said she caused death. How?
Well, absolutely. Look at Libya. That was her baby. Look, I mean, I'm not even talking about the ambassador and the people with the ambassador, young, wonderful people, with messages coming in by the hundreds, and she's not even responding. I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about all of the death that's been caused. And not only on our side, on the other side.
Their pushback would be that there were people saved by going in and taking action.
There's nothing saved. If we would have never done anything in the Middle East, we would have a much safer world right now. Getting rid of Saddam Hussein, I'm not saying he was a good person. He was a bad person. But what we have now is far worse, okay? And all of this has led to ISIS. All of this has led to the migration. All of this has led to tremendous death and destruction. And she, for the most part, was in charge of it, along with Obama.
You say you'll do more for women than Hillary Clinton. How do you think a woman's experience in daily life is different than in the modern world than a man's?
Well, I think they have a different life. I mean, it's a different life, but at the same time, I don't think women want to be pandered to. I think women don't like Hillary Clinton, to be honest with you, John. I think that women, and I see it all the time, and they tell me, you have to beat her, you have to win. She's a terrible person, she's a terrible person. Women are telling me that. I think, frankly, that women do not like Hillary Clinton.
But are women, do they have the same advantages of men in today's world? Do they?
Well, I think they've come a long way, and I think I've certainly within my company done things that were very different, because 30 years ago I had a woman in charge of building a massive building on Fifth Avenue, more than 30 years ago, and nobody would have done that in terms of construction. It was unheard of. I was way ahead. Even to this day, I have so many women executives, and they're incredible. But I have been great to women in terms of the world of business, and I've been given great credit for that.
You're going to spend $2 million on ads. What have people done?
Oh, no. I'm going to spend $2 million on ads per week, at least.
What do people not know about you that they need to see in
Honestly, I don't know. I think I'm probably wasting the money, but I'm $35 million under budget. Look, I was going to have $35 or $40 million spent by now. I haven't spent anything. I almost feel guilty. I think if you want to know the truth, I'm doing the ads. I'm leading by, as you will say, a lot. You can take the CBS poll. You can take any poll. And I'm winning by a lot. I don't think I need the ads, but I'm doing them. I almost feel guilty. And I'm $35 to $40 million under budget. I was going to have at least $35 million spent as of January 1st, which is now. I spent almost nothing. I feel guilty. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to spend a little money. I want to be certain. I want to be sure. And I think I'm going to do very well in Iowa. I think I'm going to do really well in New Hampshire. You know, New Hampshire, the polls are very, very powerful, very strong. And in Iowa, I'm leading. You know, nobody says it. In Iowa, the CNN poll, it's 33 to 20 that I'm leading. Ted Cruz is second. Nobody ever talks about that poll. That was a very major poll, probably the most expensive poll taken. But I'm at 33 to 20. I think I'm going to do very well in Iowa. And I'd love to win Iowa. And I could have said it differently. I could have said, well, I'd be okay. No, I want to win Iowa. I do great with the evangelicals, and I do great with the Tea Party, and I'm doing great. I have a real, real good feeling with Iowa.
Last question. Any New Year's resolution?
Make our country great again.
All right, Mr. Trump. Thanks so much.
Thank you very much.
We'll be right back with our political panel. Stay with us. We're back now with some analysis from our political panel. Ruth Marcus is a columnist with The Washington Post. Rehan Salam is executive editor of The National Review. Molly Ball is a politics writer for The Atlantic. And Jonathan Martin is national political correspondent for The New York Times. Rehan, I want to start with you. Donald Trump, is it essentially now his nomination to lose on the Republican side?
He has big structural disadvantages. But I'd say the biggest advantage that he has is this. You just saw him talking about, you know, all kinds of subjects. But it really is the kind of gut-level message. If you look at his support, it is heavily concentrated in parts of the country where, over the last 20 years, manufacturing jobs have disappeared in large numbers. And if you look at over the last 20 years, which industry is it that Washington has fought to support? They were really desperate to make sure that our big banks could compete with the banks in London and Tokyo and elsewhere, and so they passed a series of laws to ensure that they were in the best shape to compete globally. Whereas if you look at our industries, if you look at the Rust Belt, if you look at these parts of the country, these are parts of the country where they don't really feel like they've had friends and allies. And Donald Trump doesn't actually talk about deindustrialization or whatever else, but what he does say is that the people in charge are not listening to you, they are fundamentally untrustworthy, whereas I am plain-spoken and can be trusted. And whichever candidate is going to win the Republican nomination is someone who can channel that anger and that feeling of being left out and not listened to.
Jonathan, Donald Trump says he's going to win Iowa.
I was so struck by that there at the end, John, because so much of the expectation of these primaries is driven by what the candidates say going in, how they set up their own assumptions about what states they're going to perform well in, where they're going to win, whether they're only going to do well. And by saying that, he basically has raised the bar on his own campaign in Iowa, to the point now where if Cruz does beat him, that's going to be even more of a blow for Trump than it otherwise would have. So Trump is so Trumpian, he can't help himself, but in doing so, he has unwittingly sort of raised the bar on himself.
Oh, that's
a
winner
has
to win.
Well, he'll just deny that he said it. If he ends up losing.
But a winner has to win. And that's the challenge,
the votes are cast,
isn't it?
Yeah.
Right? When the votes are cast.
That is his challenge. But I think to answer your question to Rehan, it is his to lose right now. He may well not win Iowa. And we really still do have questions about whether these Trump voters are actually Trump voters as opposed to Trump supporters. But it is, I think the only word that comes to mind here watching your interview with him, which was terrific, is appalling in terms of his lack of substance, his lack of deep thinking, his failure to answer really serious questions like the one that you asked him about, what is the implication of your turning up in this ISIS video? Because you've said very hurtful things that really can encourage people to join ISIS, and how do you deal with that? He doesn't have answers to these questions or any serious questions, and I really just find myself thunderstruck that we're at 2016 and at this point.
All right. Well, we're going to talk about more of this, Molly, when we get back. All of you sit tight. You sit tight out there. We'll be back with more analysis from our panel.
Face the Nation after this short break.
You're a small to mid-sized business with 300 to 3,000 employees. You face the same network security challenges as big businesses do, but can't support a big IT investment, leaving your doors open to advanced cyber threats. Barracuda Next Generation Firewalls provide all the core features of enterprise firewalls and UTMs, but without hidden costs and deployment hurdles, making owning a big business firewall no big deal for your SMB. Reclaim your network. Try a Barracuda Next Gen Firewall risk-free at barracuda.com/firewalls.
Welcome back to Face the Nation. I'm John Dickerson. To talk more about all things politics, we are joined by Ruth Marcus of The Washington Post, The National Review's Rehan Salam, Molly Ball of The Atlantic, and Jonathan Martin of The New York Times. Molly, I want to pick up where we left off with Donald Trump. There is this theory that we're less than a month away from Iowa voting, that voters are going to start thinking about these candidates as president. It'll get more substantive. They'll start thinking about them in the Oval Office. Do you think that's right in this case?
It sounds like wishful thinking to me on the part mostly of the Republican establishment, which has, you know, been chasing its own tail for months about this Trump phenomenon, first thinking that somebody had to take him out, but it had to be the other guy, and then thinking, well, that we've all got to get together and do it, and that didn't work, and there's this sort of collective action problem on the part of the other candidates. But now we seem to have moved to this wishful thinking phase where, well, the voters will just wake up from this bad dream we've all been having. And, you know, I'll believe it when I see it. But most, actually all predictions about the inevitable decline of Trump have fallen short so far. I will say that I don't know if anyone actually pointed this out. When he says he's leading in Iowa, that's not true right now. All of the more recent polls actually do have Ted Cruz up in Iowa. So there's sort of a corollary to the wishful thinking that says when he loses a state, as you sort of alluded to before, he won't seem like a winner anymore. It'll sort of deflate the balloon and everybody will just peel away. So that's a possibility. But what I heard in that interview that was new to me was he was going after Ted Cruz.
On immigration.
They've had this very ostentatious love fest, the two of them so far, and in the last debate, practically hugging. And now you hear Trump actually finding a line of attack. And interestingly, we're ending the year where he started his campaign with immigration. And he has a point in what he's saying.
Which
about
never
Cruz.
Would have come up if it weren't for Donald
right.
Trump.
Right, he invented the issue. Yeah.
But will Trump do it consistently? Yeah. And that's been his challenge because he did go after Cruz in Iowa in December. And he actually started going down that road. But he couldn't keep it up because the problem is that Cruz is nice to him. He's killing him with kindness. Mm-hmm.
And the talk radio loves Cruz.
It's so hard. Yes.
That's right. They're going for the
same. It's so hard for Trump to target somebody who's nice to him. And Cruz figured that out long ago. And so his approach has been very shrewd. Cruz has, which is you hug him. Yeah. You hug him really close.
Well, the genius of Ted Cruz is also the fact that if you look at the Republican Party, if you're looking at the elite side, fundamentally you have these libertarian instincts. And what Donald Trump has demonstrated is that this libertarianism does not run very deep with actual Republican voters, not very deep at all. So what Ted Cruz has done, and you see this actually in his fundraising, what he's done is he's managed to get some of that kind of libertarian, business class, Wall Street Republican support, while also getting that kind of populist, nationalist support, a bit of that. And that also means that you get small donors as well as big donors. Trump, however, to me, what he's done, whether or not he wins, I have no idea, honestly.
Right.
But whether or not he wins, he's demonstrated that libertarianism, you know, cutting top rates, cutting cap gains taxes, all of this stuff, doesn't actually matter to real-life Republican voters. 40% of Republican voters say that they want upper-income taxpayers to pay higher taxes. Whoever do you see in a Republican primary come out and say, you know what, I'm going to leave the top rate alone, and I'm going to focus on middle-class tax cuts, something like that. Marco Rubio has flirted with this idea without really pursuing it as aggressively as he might have because he, too, has that straddle. He has to keep both sides of the party happy. But I think what Trump is demonstrating is that there's this whole other lane for Republicans to pursue, this populist, nationalist lane that is very potent.
Isn't that more affected policy, though?
With Trump, it is.
Yeah.
But he's demonstrating that there's a market for that if someone can actually sell that message. And Cruz,
fundamentally is a libertarian. He's fundamentally a guy who
wouldn't arrest him. While we're talking about a social conservative, and that's the portion of Cruz's support that I don't think Trump gets.
Yes.
Because Cruz is, and you heard Trump actually sort of going after Cruz on the religion thing, which was very weird and a little bit race-baity almost, saying that because he's Cuban, we can't be sure he's really an evangelical. But that is the portion, especially of the Iowa electorate, that I don't think is accessible to Trump for multiple reasons. And you don't hear him really trying to speak to. And so that's an advantage for Cruz, I think.
Ruth, let me ask you about this fracas between Hillary Clinton / Bill Clinton and Donald Trump. They got it into a back and forth. Hillary Clinton said Donald Trump was sexist. He said, if you want to have a full and frank conversation about how do you think that works out? You were quoted favorably by some people as having said this was fair game.
I do think it's fair game.
To
talk about Bill Clinton for two reasons. One is Hillary Clinton attacked Donald Trump appropriately and correctly for sexist remarks, of which there are many. Bill Clinton's record with women then becomes a fair game. She also has designated him as her surrogate in chief. He'll be out on the campaign trail this week. When she does both of those things, attacks Trump for sexism, picks Bill Clinton as her surrogate, his record becomes fair game. And when I say record, I'm not talking about extramarital affairs. I'm talking about his conduct, predatory, offensive, inappropriate with women, including in the Oval Office. That becomes fair for Trump to raise. Whether it affects any voters, that's a different question. I think it's smart for Trump to raise in a primary campaign. There are no Republican voters who are going to be offended by this. In a general election campaign, it's a much dicier topic.
Yeah. Does this work in the general election, Donovan, or is this just a brushback pitch? In other words, a signal to Hillary Clinton that if she doesn't want this to be talked about, she should stop attacking.
I'd be very surprised if the nominee is not Trump if they went down that road in a general election, because history has proven that it's not effective politically.
In 1998, Republicans went after Bill Clinton on this, and they had a bad year electorally.
Huge blowback.
But he does have a point with when he talks about how she's pandering to women. We do see Hillary Clinton very much leaning into sort of feminism as identity politics this time in a way she didn't in 2008, in a way that was seen as damaging and dangerous in 2008. She had to be Margaret Thatcher. She had to be tough. She had to be genderless. And this time around, it's a very different campaign that she's running. She's talking very openly about being the first woman president as an asset of her campaign, as something she wants to accomplish. So I do think that, number one, he has a point in pointing that out. Some people may be offended by it, some may not. And number two, I think Ruth is exactly right, that if Hillary is going to say that the things that Bill Clinton did that are regarded positively accrue to her credit, but the things that are negative she had nothing to do with, well, that's ridiculous, and it is fair game.
Rayhan, let's broaden this out now and talk about the larger Republican field. We've got Donald Trump. We've talked a lot about him. What do the other candidates do to make some inroads, to make a claim to win the nomination?
It's going to be very regionally specific at this point, I imagine. And, you know, as you guys all know, I mean, in New Hampshire, you have a particular quirky kind of race in which Chris Christie is doing very well. He's completely invisible in the rest of the country, but he's doing quite well there. You know, and it's all this jockeying for third place, you know, this idea that Jeb Bush needs to get into third in Iowa to be viable going forward. And I would say that over the kind of medium term, what matters is, you know, who is acceptable to everyone. As guys get knocked out, you know, kind of if someone finally says something sufficiently outrageous. And that's why Marco Rubio, who's been pretty underwhelming in early state polling, that's why he's still lurking and people still think of him as one of the big three, let's say, Trump, Cruz, and Rubio, because people still more or less finding him acceptable. People who are, you know, let's say Jeb or Christie fans certainly do, but then also people who are otherwise Cruz fans, you know, see him as, you know, he's basically conservative, made this one huge mistake on immigration from their perspective. But that, I think, is going to matter more. And also, this could be a race in which actually one can preserve one's viability after not having done well in the first two or three primaries. It seems likely to me.
Ruth, let me ask you about this terrorist video and Donald Trump's role in it. It seems to me that if we go back to this notion, Molly called it wishful thinking, that voters start to look at the candidates as president. This is a case, somebody would say, where Donald Trump's mouth had real consequences. Do you think there's any strength in that argument that anybody's going to be able to use this against Trump, this video, the fact he was used in a terrorist video, that has anything, or is this just another instance in which Trump supporters won't mind and it'll be fine?
Well, I'm tempted to engage in some wishful thinking. the consequences of Trump's outrageous statements, of which we could go on for three more hours, don't seem to be affecting his support among voters.
Right.
So it's hard for me to see that this one does. At the same time, I have been waiting to see and kind of hoping to see the electability moment happen among voters. You certainly hear that in past cycles from voters, particularly in New Hampshire, where they, you know, Republican voters ought to be saying, it's our turn, right. We need the White House back, and they ought to be looking at Trump and saying, he's not going to get us
there. How do the candidates raise that against Trump, which you haven't heard yet, but I think you will hear in the coming weeks? It's remarkable that on January 3rd, we are looking at a primary where it's entirely plausible that Donald Trump rolls and becomes the nominee, and it's also plausible that he does not win a single state.
In the general election or in the primary.
Just don't know what's going to happen. We just don't know what's going to happen. And I think we have to basically acknowledge that this is a very uncertain territory that we're entering. But what is striking is the degree to which nobody is even confronting the front runner. If you believe it's Trump, and Molly mentioned this, you know, where is the money against him? He has not been touched at all. Howard Dean in 2004 was widely seen as a disaster against George W. Bush. The Democratic establishment rallied and targeted him. You would not see anything like that this time around, which makes this an entirely different kind of race. And I think that's in part because, as Molly pointed out, a lot of folks in the establishment are skeptical that his folks will actually show up. But it's also because they don't want to get in a tit-for-tat with him because they know that he hits back hard. So the end result of that is to have this guy, less than a month before Iowa, completely untouched.
I think Jonathan talked about something important, which is the dog that hasn't barked this campaign. It was supposed to be all about money. It was supposed to be all about super PACs. Jeb Bush's super PAC has spent something like $50 million
on ads
that have...
But we haven't,
received, we haven't gotten
we
to
haven't seen,
nothing, scorched
but
earth.
But it's been really remarkable how little impact money has had
but we haven't
so
seen negative
far
ads
in
yet,
this
though.
Race.
And
right.
We've seen a little negative on the non-Trump. In other words, it's everybody else attacking each other, not going after the big dog. Speaking of money, we've got to talk about the Democrats in our remaining minutes here. Bernie Sanders put out this interesting quote, Molly, when he released his fundraising numbers. He had a very good, strong number. And at the end, he says, quote, incredibly, the vast majority of all the money we have raised comes from small dollar contributions. You won't see that from our opponent. I don't go around asking a handful of millionaires and billionaires for big checks and call it a day. Boom. That's right at Hillary Clinton. That's about
absolutely.
Money. Is that effective?
I think it's very effective. If you're on the trail with Bernie Sanders and he starts to rail against Citizens United, it is very much at the heart of his candidacy, this complaint about money in politics. And interestingly, Trump echoes him a little bit there, because I do think this is a completely bipartisan phenomenon, the anger at money in politics. Yeah. It's very important. $33 million for Bernie Sanders in the fourth quarter versus $55 million for Hillary Clinton. And this is her, you know, holding fundraisers multiple times a day, and he has held, I believe, one.
Right.
So that is really remarkable. And it tells you that, you know, look, I don't think Bernie Sanders is likely to win this Democratic primary, but he will have made a huge impact and had a huge voice by proving that there is this liberal groundswell out there, proving that there is a segment of the Democratic Party that wants to hear the things that he is saying. He's already forced Hillary to the left on issues, but more than that, I think he's telling us something about this national mood and what voters are concerned about.
Well, but imagine if Bernie were more charismatic. I mean, when you think about that amount of money relative to the amount of money that Americans spend on, tight pants, for example, I mean, it's just not that impressive. I actually am surprised that he didn't raise more money. And this whole idea that it's all small donors, how amazing is that? But that also is why he's so weak. You know, go back to Ted Cruz. Here's a guy raising from big donors and small donors. He's got the balance. Yeah. Jeb Bush, only from big guys. So you want to have that balance. And even if Hillary Clinton is underwhelming, she at least is able to connect with, let's say, some unmarried white lower middle class women who might be willing to write her a $20 check, as well as the rich guys in D.C. and L.A. So I think that that's why Bernie... You know, ultimately, you know, any candidate in that lane was going to raise a fair bit of money.
But
I would not have predicted that.
We're going to have to cut you off there. So thanks all very much to our panel. We'll be right back. Joining us now is former White House National Security Advisor Tom Donilon.
and former deputy CIA director and CBS News national security contributor, Michael Morrell. Tom, I want to start with the news with you. The Saudi embassy in Tehran was ransacked after Saudi Arabia executed a cleric who'd been critical of the Sunni kingdom's treatment of Shiites. What's the significance of this?
Well, I think a couple of things. One, the reaction was predicted and predictable. Two, at the same time that the United States is seeking to lower tensions in the region in pursuit of an effort against ISIS and a political process in Syria, this raises tensions. And three, I think it reflects a couple of things. It's one of the key conflict dynamics in the Middle East, the Sunni-Shia dynamic. It reflects, I think, how Saudi Arabia sees the threat both internally in Saudi Arabia and the kingdom, but also externally. And it needs to be said that Iran is a principal force for destabilization in the region. And Iran looks around at what Saudi Arabia looks around and sees what Iran is doing in Beirut and in Damascus and in Sana'a and in Baghdad and feels, I think, a threat. And it also reflects this competition for influence in the region between Saudi Arabia and Iran. So it's an increase in tensions at a time when the United States is trying to decrease tensions in pursuit of major policy objectives.
I just wanted to add that I think the Iranians in this case acted responsibly. The police showed up very quickly. They made a number of arrests. I hope the Iraqi government acts as responsibly. The Saudis just last week opened up an embassy in Baghdad for the first time in 25 years. I hope this doesn't reverse that.
Let's stay in Iraq. Ramadi has been retaken or partially retaken by Iraqi forces. Why is that so important, retaken from ISIS, which took it in May? Why is that important?
It's important for two reasons, John. The first is what was taken from ISIS, and the second is who took it. In the what was taken, right, this is a strategically significant city, the largest city in Anbar province, the capital of Anbar province, where the Sunnis in Iraq live, on the strategic road to Syria, on the strategic highway to Jordan, 70 miles from Baghdad, an embarrassment to the Iraqi government when they lost it 7 months ago. So what was taken is of significance. And then the who took it, right? All of the gains to date in Iraq have been by the Kurds or by Shia militia. In this case, it was Iraqi security forces.
Yeah. Tom, will we look back on this and say this was a turning point for the reasons Mike outlines?
Oh, well, I think it's important progress, no doubt about that, and a part of continuing progress against ISIS, where they've lost about 30% of the territory that they had at the height of their sweep across Iraq. But I think it also needs to be put in some perspective as well. Number one, we have a long way to go. This operation took 8 months, 630 or so U.S. Airstrikes, a tremendous amount of support for the Iraqi security forces in pulling this off. Second, it's a smaller city. It's an important city, as Michael said. It's the capital, the provincial capital in Anbar. But the next phase is Mosul, perhaps, as the Iraqi prime minister said. And Mosul's five times as big as Ramadi. And third, there are challenges in Ramadi. We'll have to provide security. The Iraqis have to provide security. People need to know if they come back there, they're going to be secure. We'll need to see reconstruction. The United States and other countries have pledged $50 million for reconstruction. And most importantly, we need to see progress towards inclusion of Sunnis in Anbar politically in Iraq.
Mike, there was a story by Karen DeYoung in the Washington Post this week about the president being frustrated that his ISIS strategy, the countering of ISIS strategy, was not getting the kind of public relations explanation that he wanted, and that he was getting a bad rap for things. What do you make of that argument, that this is a communications failure more than an actual failure on combating ISIS? And secondarily, how has the fight against ISIS picked up since, you know, in the last 2 months?
So I think what you're likely to see, John, over the next year is without a diplomatic settlement in Syria, I think what you're likely to see is a growing gap between success in Iraq militarily. It looks like the Iraqi security forces are beginning to get their act together. That's very important. They do face challenges, as Tom has said. So a growing gap between success in Iraq and a lack of success in Syria. So I think that's where the diplomatic focus needs to be, the military focus needs to be in Syria going forward.
You know, there's no doubt that the Iraqi security forces are being improving in terms of their capability. We saw that in Ramadi. And I think progress can be made against ISIS militarily. And indeed, I think it's critical in 2016 that the United States and the coalition of some 60 countries who are facing off against ISIS break the narrative of success. Mm-hmm. That's the key recruiting tool that this group has around the world. And that's important because this group, and I do think we'll make serious progress against them in 2016, they have metastasized. They're kind of indiscriminate franchisers, right? And we've seen them present real challenges around the world, including in places like Libya, which I think will end up being challenges for us going into 2016.
Let me ask you, Tom, about that metastasization question. People have had some difficulty putting ISIS in context. You know, Marco Rubio calls it a clash of civilizations between radical Islam and the West. Others have said, no, this is just a fight against a big group, ISIS, which needs to be taken care of, but it doesn't have that kind of cultural breadth. Help us put this into some frame.
Well, it's a unique challenge, I think, in some ways an unprecedented challenge. It has controlled territory. It's an insurgency in Iraq. It threatened the Iraqi state. It is well-financed from a variety of means. It is has a top-down control structure. It has also been the recipient of some 30,000 foreign fighters. That's the largest kind of compilation or aggregation of fighters we've ever seen in a circumstance like this. So it's a unique challenge. But two other things make it unique, in addition to the foreign fighters who ultimately could come home. It has taken advantage of technology. And really, ISIS and a number of the other groups we see in the world have come to a nexus with technology, which has allowed them to recruit more broadly than just in the theater in Syria and Iraq. And that's what we've seen. We've seen that through the establishment of these provincial or other franchises, if you will, around the world. And we've also seen it in their ability to radicalize individuals and groups around the world to take action. That is a unique and new challenge.
Let me just, in our last couple minutes we have here, we got a year ahead of us. Mike, what should we be keeping our eye on in terms of big challenges in this next year, say outside of ISIS, which we've talked about?
So I think one big challenge is going to be the reemergence of Afghanistan as an issue. The Taliban have made major gains over the last year. I would expect similar gains going forward. They control more territory now than they have in a number of years. I think the debate on how many troops we keep in Afghanistan is going to reopen. General Campbell already last week said we need upwards of 10,000 troops, which is double the number the president is currently looking at.
Yeah. Tom, your thoughts about
it? Well, I think that we have a continuing challenge with respect to ISIS, and I think that's the principal security challenge. I think Michael's right about Afghanistan. I think also you'll see in the final year of President Obama's term a big emphasis on foreign policy and national security. If you look at the calendar between now and the end of President Obama's term, there's a major event or foreign policy trip every month during the course of it. And that's presidents typically go in this direction because they have much more freedom to act in foreign policy than they do in domestic and legislatively in the last year. And I think you'll see that, and there'll be challenges to deal with. There'll be consolidation and implementation of things that the president's already put in place and some opportunity. You know, for example, he'll be in Asia twice. He'll have Asia-related events four times. He's seeing President Xi three times in order to try to consolidate the Asia rebalance.
Mike, quickly, last 30 seconds, reports the U.S. spying on Israeli officials. Put that into context or explain it to us.
So can't comment about specific intelligence activities, of course. And in this case, I don't know what exactly was happening, right? It's been 3 years since I've been in government. But I'd say a couple things. One is we're looking at two different issues here. One issue is a decision to spy, perhaps, on a leader of an ally, right? That's a decision that's made at the highest levels of our government. That's where it should be made. And I would say that we should always keep open the option of being able to spy on anybody when it's on our national security interests. The second issue is how information with regard to Netanyahu's discussions about his relationship with the U.S. Congress are handled by the intelligence community. There are very specific rules about that, and the Congress is looking into whether those rules were followed in this case.
All right, Mike Brown, thanks so much, Tom Donilon. We'll be back in a moment. That's it for today. Be sure to tune in next week. We'll be talking with the new Speaker of the House, Paul Ryan. Until then, for Face the Nation, I'm John Dickerson. I'm John Dickerson, and this has been Face the Nation. Today's guests were Donald Trump, former Obama National Security Advisor Tom Donilon, and former CIA Deputy Director Michael Morell. The executive producer of Face the Nation is Mary Hager. The senior producer is Jill Jackson. This broadcast was directed by Brian Nailsnick. Face the Nation originates from CBS News in Washington. For more Face the Nation, we're online at facethenation.com. And you can follow Face the Nation, John Dickerson, and CBS Radio News on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram.